As AI continues to revolutionize our world, there's a critical conversation we can't ignore: AI safety and security. And that's where HackerOne's AI red teaming comes into play, rigorously testing AI models to prevent them from being misled or exploited. HackerOne employs over 2 million ethical hackers, and 750 of them specialize in prompt hacking and other AI security and testing. So HackerOne isn't just theorizing, they're actively safeguarding AI's future. Just recently, a team unearthed over 100 vulnerabilities in just 2 weeks. So whether you're at the helm of a startup or steering product innovation at a large company, it's time to prioritize AI security. Visit HackerOne.com/AI for more. Again, HackerOne.com/AI.
This episode is sponsored by porkbun.com. Porkbun is a refreshingly different domain name registrar that's different from the other ones like GoDaddy or Namecheap. They've got low prices on hundreds of different domain extensions. They've got everything from .com domains to really cool ones like .pro, .dev, .xyz. Every domain name at Porkbun comes with tons of freebies too, like SSL certificate, whois privacy, DNS, URL forwarding, and hosting trials. Because why pay for things that should be free, right? All these incredible features and tools are backed by incredible support, 365 days a year, and more 5-star reviews on Trustpilot from real customers than anyone else. Look, you can get $1 off your next domain name from Porkbun and see why they're the best domain name registrar around by using our code. Just go to porkbun.com/rocketshipfm24. That's porkbun, porkbun.com/rocketshipfm24. You'll save $1 on your next domain. This episode is brought to you by Gigantic. At Gigantic, you can level up your product skills through live, small group, cohort-based trainings. We're incredibly excited to welcome you to our next cohort of our product strategy training, kicking off in January of 2024. This course will take you through the frameworks that product leaders use at companies like eBay, DoorDash, Groupon, Rent the Runway, in order to scale their teams. It's taught by Ben Foster, a friend of this podcast, who is the former chief product officer at Whoop. So come join us. Go to gigantic.is. That's gigantic.is. And save your seat for our January cohort. Your potential is gigantic, and we're here to help you reach it. Go to gigantic.is to reserve your seat today.
Michael, I have a question for you. Mm-hmm. Did you have any hobbies when you were growing up?
Yeah, sure. I collected baseball cards, starting lineup figures, a lot of sports-related hobbies, I'd say.
All right. Yeah, well, then we definitely have something in common. I was definitely a big sports card collector back then. Baseball was mostly my thing, but I dabbled a little bit of football and basketball, too, and I don't know, I probably have like 50,000 cards still in my attic somewhere.
Yeah, I think most people our age have that attic stash. What would you say your prized possession from this time was?
Well, my favorite, I don't know the value or anything like that, but my favorite is a 1959 Topps baseball card that features the entire Cleveland Indians outfield, which is Rocky Colavito, Minnie Minoso, Larry Doby, all of them Cleveland legends. And actually, Larry Doby is even in the Baseball Hall of Fame now. And so the cool thing about it, too, is I actually met every single one of them and got them to sign that card.
Wow, that's awesome. Yeah, but this episode isn't about baseball cards or...
No, but the company we're featuring sort of has its roots there in a way.
Okay, go on.
Well, back in the mid-90s, if you bought and traded sports cards like I did and you did, you could do so among friends or at local shops or even in the ballroom of some Holiday Inn at a weekend sports card show.
Into those. Yeah.
Yes, but then there's this website that allowed you to do it with somebody across the country because that's when eBay was born.
eBay, which started off as that peer-to-peer online auction site that we all know and some of us love. And while it still is, you know, they do regular e-commerce now as well. It's really ballooned into a massive global platform. So today's show is...
not about eBay.
Ah, okay. All right. Well,
it's about the service that was offered alongside eBay to actually pay for the stuff you bought. Because you see, at first, the process
you might remember it. You bid on a baseball card. You'd have to then physically mail a check. And once it finally got to the seller, they'd wait for it to clear and you'd finally get your baseball card back at maybe, I don't know, weeks later, until the service was offered and integrated into the process. And that service...
Okay, so this is PayPal.
Definitely, you got it. PayPal. A company that started off as an online bank that wasn't really a bank, but also offered this side service that allowed you to email money to somebody, which really, really took off.
And let's face it, what makes PayPal so special isn't even just the product itself, which flourished and still does, but all of the entrepreneurs and companies that were born out of it. LinkedIn, Facebook, Tesla, Yelp, they were all started by members of what's known as the PayPal Mafia.
I'm going to make them an offer he can't refuse.
That was a clip from the eventual acquirer of PayPal and its acquisition of the service.
No, it wasn't. That was a clip from The Godfather.
Okay, fair enough. And we're probably getting ahead of ourselves anyway. So it's time to rewind back to the beginning as we start this product journey of PayPal for this week's episode of Rocketship.fm, which starts right
now. Welcome to Rocketship.fm.
Rocketship FM is produced in partnership with Product Collective.
We are your hosts, Michael Sacca.
And I'm Mike Belsito.
The year was 1998. A then 23-year-old Max Levchin was relatively new to Silicon Valley after having just moved to Palo Alto from Champaign-Urbana, where he attended undergraduate studies at the University of Illinois. He was in Silicon Valley with a goal of starting something, but not much going on this one particular afternoon. So he decided to attend a lecture that was happening right on the campus of Stanford University.
That lecture was given by 31-year-old Peter Thiel, and it was the first time that the two had ever met. Here's Levchin and Thiel together at Stanford University in a campus visit filmed in 2004 in the very same building where they first met, a meeting that would lead to a legendary series of companies being built and entrepreneurial careers being established.
So although we didn't meet in this room, particularly we met in a room upstairs, and the room upstairs was being used by Peter to give a talk on financial markets and currency trading. And I basically went there because I just moved to Palo Alto from Champaign-Urbana, which is where I went to school, and pretty much was bumming around during the summer just trying to see what to do next with my life. So I went to see this guy, Peter Thiel, who was giving a free lecture or free talk about currency markets, and figured it would be like a filled auditorium, but it actually turned out to be a lecture with six people in it. So it was fairly easy to make contact afterwards, and since I was sort of the right combination of jumpy to do something new and just bored enough to talk to anyone who could listen, I came up to this guy and said, you know, I'm this guy Max, I've been in Silicon Valley for the last 5 days, and I'm gonna start a new company, and how are you doing? And that's the beginning of my version of the story.
As for Thiel, well, he was looking for entrepreneurs to invest in. Of course, the Peter Thiel of 1998 wasn't the prolific investor that most people know now. In fact, he's really just getting started as an investor. He had some experience as a securities lawyer and a derivatives trader, so financial markets are what he knew. But with the advent of the internet, he also saw opportunity. And particularly when he met Levchin, it seemed like that opportunity was knocking right at his door. Here's Thiel at that same Stanford visit with his side of when he and Levchin first met.
You know, at the time I decided that, so this was in 98, I was running a small fund, and I was thinking that the best thing at the time to do was to start a company in Silicon Valley. And a bunch of my friends had started companies, and you know, there's all this crazy different stuff that happens. I've been involved in a variety of companies that have sort of blown up in catastrophic ways where, you know, people teamed up and they started the company, and it was sort of like marrying the first person one met at a slot machine in Las Vegas. So, you know, you might hit the jackpot, but chances were things would just blow up catastrophically. And, all sorts of bizarre things where, you know, within a matter of weeks, everybody hated everybody else in the company, and they may have had great business plans, but didn't matter at all. And so I thought it made sense to try to get involved a little bit more, you know, in getting one of these businesses started at the very beginning. And that fall, Max and I spent a lot of time brainstorming different ideas on different types of markets. Max wanted to do something with crypto. I wanted to do something with, he'd done a lot of work on encryption technology. I wanted to do something with finance. And we finally decided that we wanted to try to do something with encrypted money on Palm Pilots. We thought this was going to be the future of the world. And the two of us jointly started this company called Confinity, initially FieldLink, but then renamed Confinity in December of 98.
Like so many great startup and product success stories, the actual business that blossomed isn't the one that they originally started with. Back then, the concept revolved around the secure encryption of Palm Pilots and the ability to essentially beam each other money. And it wasn't called PayPal. What became PayPal was first FieldLink and then later Confinity. And certainly at the time, not everybody thought it was a very good idea.
Some people thought that beaming each other money with your Palm Pilot was in fact a horrible idea. Here's a 60-minute appearance that Thiel once made where he admitted as much.
Of course, you build products that don't work. When we started PayPal, the initial product was an infrared beaming device on Palm Pilots for sending money. It was voted one of the 10 worst business ideas in 1999. And 1999 was a year where there were many bad ideas in technology. And so there was a product failure, but the team was good. We were able to change and do something different.
A product failure. Didn't we already do that season?
Yeah. I mean, of course, this was hardly that, right, though? Although it could have been. The PayPal team quickly realized that not everybody had Palm Pilots. And if you're sitting around a dinner table and want to pay your friends for the meal that he or she just picked up the tab for, it would be impossible to beam them money if they didn't have a Palm Pilot just like you.
And so a pivot would soon be in order.
Before they quite got to that pivot, though, Thiel funded the venture with an investment of his own in January of 1999, along with the initial angel investors of Scott Bannister and Kevin Hartz. Just a few months later, the name PayPal was officially introduced as the product feature.
And by October of 1999, that pivot finally came. Anybody with an email address could send money to somebody else.
So Mike, when you were building your baseball card empire, let's call it, just how early of a user were you? Were you a Palm Pilot beaming guy or?
I mean, I was an early user, but having a Palm Pilot in high school, I may have had a pager, maybe. I don't know if I'll admit that or not. But no, I did not get my first Palm Pilot until college. Let me be clear.
Okay, fair enough.
Anyway, the early launch of PayPal, it started steady, but then it started to turn really, really good. And then good turned into great, at least in terms of user growth. In fact, one of PayPal's co-founders, Luke Nosek, he was focused on the marketing side, and he came up with one of the first early growth hacks. Sign up for a new account and get $10 in your PayPal account. Get a friend to sign up and you get another $10.
We see that strategy time and time again with countless other startups.
Yeah, well, they can thank Luke for being one of the pioneers of that concept. There's just one problem though.
What's that?
Well, when it works, yes, user growth can be rampant, but also very, very expensive. Here's Thiel again from that Stanford visit from 2004.
Well, we plotted, the viral marketing started in October. We launched October 22nd, 99 with 24 people in the office, sending emails to other people. And the first month or two was slow. We were up to 1,000 by mid-November, 12,000 by the end of December of 99. It grew by about 5 to 7% compounding daily. It was 100,000 by February 2nd of 2000 and about 1 million by mid-April. And the eBay subset was growing even faster. It was compounding at about 7 to 10% a day. It definitely was growing extraordinarily fast. The slightly worrisome component to me as CEO, and even more so to our CFO, who used to work at Silicon Valley Bank, which was sort of a very traditional bank, was that with the exponential customer growth, there was an exponential growth in expenses because they were all costing $20. So you could plot the exponential curve of the customer growth, and one could also plot the burn rate, which was growing exponentially as well. By early March of 2000. We had raised some more venture capital money. We had $15 million in the bank, which is a decent, respectable amount. But the burn rate of this, there were no revenues and, of course, no profits. But the burn rate was running at about $10 million a month. When you sort of plotted out, the whole thing was going to blow up in 6 weeks. We had various company meetings with the engineers. And, it's like, well, we need to take over the world. We can't slow down now.
So what does a Silicon Valley company do when you're experiencing massive user growth but quickly running out of money?
Let me guess, raise more money?
Well, let's go back to Levchin.
One of the things that occurred at the time, we merged with our largest competitor, X.com.
A merger with a competitor, X.com, another company experiencing exponential growth, who was also running out of money.
Yeah, on one hand, this seemed crazy. I mean, two companies combining forces that are so rapidly losing money. But on the other,
they were both growing like crazy. And these were fierce rivals at the time, located exactly four blocks away from each other on University Avenue. And combined, they'd be a force. So just 1 month after merging, the collective company, who at the time took on the X.com name, raised $100 million in March of 2000, which, if you might remember, was just before the dot-com bubble started to burst.
Yet there's also one more notable thing about this merger. One of the most famous members of the PayPal mafia came to PayPal by way of that merger with X.com. Today, you'd know him as the founder of companies like Tesla and SpaceX.
Ah, Elon Musk.
Yes, and by April of 2000, Musk became the CEO of the combined company. But it wouldn't be for long.
We'll learn more about Musk and his role at this stage, along with a laundry list of others who have gone on to do amazing things, right after a quick break to hear from our sponsors. This episode is brought to you by Yahoo Finance. Wouldn't it be great if you could see all of your investment and retirement accounts in one place? With Yahoo Finance, you can consolidate your views with multiple accounts into one hub and access the expert analysis you need to tend to your entire portfolio with confidence. Honestly, this has been a lifesaver for me. I've used Yahoo Finance to consolidate all of my various 401k and investment accounts so I can see everything all in one place. And it makes it incredibly easy to manage. So if you're struggling with that, check out Yahoo Finance. For over 25 years, Yahoo Finance has been the brand behind every great investor. You can securely link your brokerage accounts for a unified view of your wealth, including your 401k and other investments. A comprehensive perspective is what sets apart a great investor, and that's how Yahoo Finance ensures that you have the insights to look at your wealth in its entirety. So go to yahoofinance.com. That's yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination. When Rainn Wilson realized he had a special gift for talking people to sleep, he had two choices: construct a massive speaker that would blast his voice to every person in the country, or invent a talking pillow. AT&T Business eventually talked him into the pillow thing. And backed by a reliable network, the only network with built-in security controls, Sleep with Rainn was a hit. Take your ideas to the moon and beyond at business.att.com. That's business.att.com.
Just 3 years ago, I was showering at the Y and sleeping on the office floor. And now, obviously, I've got a million-dollar car and quite a few creature comforts.
After making a fortune with his first successful startup, Zip2, Musk gained fame as the co-founder of PayPal in the late 1990s.
So this is an ATM. What we're going to do is transform the traditional banking industry.
That was from a New York Times video that was produced in 2018 profiling Elon Musk, one of the co-founders and financiers of X.com, which merged with PayPal. And shortly after the merger, it was Musk who was leading the company, at least for a few months.
Those few months after the merger were pretty tense. Musk was often at odds with the board of directors and other management team members when it came to the vision and product strategy for PayPal. On one hand, Musk was an incredibly important part of PayPal. Not only was he CEO, but after the merger, he was the largest shareholder. But not everybody saw eye to eye with him.
In fact, this culture clash between the two merged groups ultimately led to a big departure. But that departure wasn't Musk, actually. At least not at first. It was Peter Thiel who left.
But a few months after the merger happened, Musk left for a two-week trip, and he came back to a harsh new reality. Here's Musk with Max Chafkin of Inc. magazine talking about that fateful trip.
You know, I think it's not a good idea to leave the office when there are like a lot of major things underway which are causing people a great deal of stress.
Yeah.
But it was a combination of needing to raise money, and I'd gotten married earlier that year and not had any vacation or honeymoon or anything, so it was kind of a combined financing trip / honeymoon.
Yeah.
And and anyway, but away for 2 weeks, and there was just so much, there was just a lot of worry And that caused the management team to decide that I wasn't the right guy to run the company. And so the board was like, you know, geez, what do we do? So basically, I could have fought it really hard, but instead I said, you know, rather than fight it at this critical time, best to sort of concede.
And so Musk did concede and step down as CEO, although he did remain the chairman.
And back came Peter Thiel to run what was still known at the time as X.com. And despite the drama of the merger, the executive infighting, PayPal was thriving as a product. From January 2000 to August, PayPal saw its accounts jump from 12,000 to 2.7 million. That's over a 200 times increase for those of you running numbers in your head.
I was actually trying to run the numbers.
I know you were. I totally know you were.
That success that PayPal was having, aside from the genius growth hacking that was going on, it owed a lot of its success to that very same company we started the episode with.
Ah, yes, eBay. So at this stage of the company, over 25% of the transactions that happened on eBay were processed by PayPal. And it's not as if this was the only option either. I mean, at this point, eBay had its own payment method, yet it was used just a fraction compared to how often eBay's buyers and sellers were using PayPal.
And this was actually another big product innovation, really, embedding itself inside of another product. While we see many examples of this today in so many different ways, it was pretty revolutionary back then, and it really accounted for a lot of PayPal's early growth and success.
But that continued growth and success, it was still expensive. Difference now, though, was that PayPal was actually pulling in some revenue. By the end of the year 2000, it had generated over $14 million of revenue, which is more than plenty of startups would dream to generate in their first year.
But there's a catch.
Yeah, a big catch.
Its total operating expenses in the year 2000 was, well, just a hair over $14
million. Yeah, you can say that.
Okay, maybe a few hairs. It was $174 million in the year of 2000. So all of that money raised initially, including that additional $100 million round raised in April of that year, it was all pretty much gone.
Yeah, they needed somebody to beam them money and fast.
I knew eventually a comment like that was going to come in from you, Mike.
I had to. It was a perfect setup. Anyway, it was time for PayPal to raise money once again. And so they did in a major way. In 2001, they determined that it was time to go public and IPO. Here's Peter Thiel back in that conversation at Stanford telling the story of how PayPal originally went public. And it's quite a story. It involves everything from 9/11 to Louisiana bureaucrats and even Mardi Gras. And no, this isn't the Stefan sketch from Saturday Night Live either. Here's Peter Thiel.
We had a burn rate of, I believe it was $12 million a month in September of 2000. By September of 2001, we turned the dial enough. The company was basically at break even. And that's when we started the whole IPO process, which, you know, Max went ahead to the end, was at the end of the day very successful. There were certainly many crazy ups and downs in between. The most insane one, we filed for going public September 28th, 2001. We were the first company to do so after September 11th. And I thought this would be a cool thing to do because nobody else would be doing it. The unfortunate downside was that we got, you know, way more scrutiny than we otherwise would have. It started with the SEC with our bad luck on the draw, where we drew a very short straw. One of the questions in the SEC is who actually reviews these companies? And it turned out to be there was one person at the SEC who was ideologically opposed to companies and who thought that all companies in the U.S. were run by crooks. And it was his job as an SEC regulator to prevent companies from ever going public. And normally what happened if you had the bad luck of getting this SEC regulator to review you, it'd be a very long process. And eventually his supervisors would override him. But there were all these scandals with other companies, and there were people who started thinking, you know, maybe this guy's been right all these 20 years, and maybe no company should be allowed to go public anymore in the U.S. And so one of the crazy things that happened in the last month was it was a Business Week article written on us, which in January of 2002, which said PayPal is a great business, but it unfortunately has all these banking regulatory problems. In particular, it's unclear what the regulatory status is in Louisiana, Idaho, New York, and California. And there was this one mid-level bureaucrat in Louisiana who said, well, we don't know what they're doing, but if they're involved in unregulated banking, they have to stop. And then the guy at the SEC read the article and called up the state of Louisiana, and then he called us up and announced to us, well, you know, you have to disclose that you've been shut down from doing business in Louisiana. And this led to quite a panic because it was a whole network. And if you're, even though Louisiana was not that important a state, if we were stopped in Louisiana, people might think that we'd be stopped in a lot of other places. And so on the eve of the IPO, behind the scenes, there was this frantic effort to be authorized to do business in Louisiana. This was in the middle of Mardi Gras in New Orleans, and I managed to track down in the middle of Mardi Gras the ex-banking commissioner of Louisiana. We sort of talked about this, and he agreed that Louisiana didn't really want to. You know, we point out we had 100,000 customers in Louisiana. They were using the product 3,000 times a day. Did they really want to deal with all these people who did, after all, vote in elections in Louisiana? And he agreed that, yeah, you know, maybe Louisiana didn't really want to get a reputation as an unusually backward state, and perhaps they should revisit this. And so, morning after Mardi Gras was over, we were back allowed to do business in Louisiana officially, and the company successfully went public about a week later.
So PayPal eventually does go public in 2002, and while an IPO might seem like a good place to end the product journey story, we're not quite done yet.
No, because just a few months later, somebody finally came knocking at PayPal's door to talk about an acquisition. And it's somebody that everybody in the world probably would have predicted, eBay. Just months after PayPal's IPO, eBay decided that it was finally time to acquire PayPal. And so it did so in a stock purchase at over $1 billion. And while billion-dollar acquisitions seem like they happen every day now, I mean, this was back in 2002. This is a really big deal.
And remember Elon Musk, who had departed as CEO? Well, he was about to get paid. In fact, the deal meant a windfall of over $165 million.
Of course, he's not the only one that benefited from the transaction. Other team members were about to get paid too. But more than the money that they were going to earn, their experience from being at PayPal during this time would prove to be even more valuable. Here's Connor Forrest of Tech Republic describing this group of people who helped shape the early days of PayPal.
After PayPal sold to eBay in 2002, many of the original team members went on to create and invest in some of the most successful companies in the tech industry. Companies like Tesla, YouTube, Palantir, Yelp, SpaceX, Yammer, and LinkedIn. Unicorn firms with market caps well over $1 billion. Their reputation for picking winners, and the fact that so many of them were connected to Silicon Valley's best success stories of the post-dot-com era, eventually earned them the nickname of the PayPal Mafia.
More on the PayPal Mafia after the break.
So obviously the story of PayPal doesn't end with the acquisition from eBay. I mean, PayPal still exists now and thrives today. In fact, since the time that eBay acquired it, it's grown even more. It spun out of eBay and it went public again. Its stock today has never been higher.
But more impressive than PayPal's growth is the growth of the individuals that helped bring it to life in the first place, known as the PayPal Mafia.
Yeah, no other group of people inside of one company has gone on to have as much success as the early employees of PayPal. There are quite a few people who could stake the claim that they were a part of the PayPal Mafia, but let's highlight a few and just talk about some of the ones that we might be familiar with.
Well, we've already talked about some of the big ones, Max Levchin, Peter Thiel, and Elon Musk. Levchin has gone on to start multiple companies, including Slide, which sold to Google for over $100 million, and Affirm, which still exists today. Thiel went on to start Palantir, which was valued at one point at over $20 billion, but he's better known for his investing prowess. He is one of the first outside investors at this little company called Facebook. His $500,000 investment for just 10% of the company turned into over $1 billion just a few years later.
Yeah, and Elon Musk, well, he's basically turned into a real-life Tony Stark, starting companies like SpaceX, Tesla, Hyperloop. Today, the enigmatic Musk is worth over $36 billion.
But there were plenty of others behind the scenes at PayPal. Like, for instance, David Sacks, the founding COO and product leader at PayPal, would eventually go on to start Yammer, another company to be later acquired for over $1 billion. Sacks also became a prolific angel investor.
Yeah, there's also Reid Hoffman, another COO for PayPal. Hoffman would go on to start a social network for professionals. You may have heard of it. LinkedIn. One of the billionaires to spawn out of the PayPal mafia, Hoffman's now known as the most connected man in Silicon Valley.
Jeremy Stoppelman and Russell Simmons, both early employees, co-founded a company together that probably every listener here has at least used, Yelp. So if you didn't know that you could thank PayPal for finding that five-star review that led you to the hole-in-the-wall diner you now love, well, now you know.
Yes, you now know. And Jawad Karim and Steve Chen, two PayPal engineers, they later team up with Chad Hurley, who actually designed PayPal's first logo, to start another company that I'm sure you've used before. Or in the case of my seven-year-old son, spend hours and hours and hours on, and that's YouTube.
Early employees and executives Keith Rabloy and Dave McClure went on to become pretty prolific investors themselves. And there's a countless list of people who have gone on to experience great success as either entrepreneurs or investors that we don't even have time to mention today.
Yeah. While PayPal's product innovations and early growth helped it achieve such quick success as a business, the development of this PayPal mafia is probably the most impressive accomplishment of all. And if you think about it, the entrepreneurs and companies, they don't just stop with these ones that we're naming here.
What do you mean?
Well, what new startup is going to spawn based on what an early employee at LinkedIn learns from Reid Hoffman? Or what engineer at Tesla is going to take what they've learned from Elon Musk and go build something big on their own? Or what investors learning under the tutelage of Peter Thiel and now is going to invest in the next Facebook?
It's so true. And hey, it's already happening. And in a part, they'll have PayPal to thank as well.
Well, since we're talking about the team behind PayPal, to finish this episode, I'm going to end this with a clip from Forbes magazine of Reid Hoffman and Peter Thiel talking about what made that early PayPal team so special. It wasn't the deep industry experience that everybody had in financial markets. In fact, it was in a way the exact opposite.
In particular, what we had learned from the kind of the PayPal experience was a really interesting learning, and that you could actually go revolutionize an industry with people who are very smart, working hard, and deploying a technology that people hadn't seen before.
Yes.
Right. And so suddenly, which industries you might possibly go at become a much broader scope as a function of our experience at PayPal. Because, you know, like I would say that if when we had conversations around this, you know, like say
pre-PayPal,
you know, early, mid-90s, it was kind of like, well, we'd have to be really focused because we thought the number of opportunities.
We have to start with what we know.
Yes, exactly. Whereas, you know, part of the whole thing is, remember, like, you know, start with PayPal was, you know, learning basic things about the financial services industry. Yeah,
chargebacks, what's that?
Yes, exactly. And so I think one of the things that was really instrumental, we also realized that assembling a crew of people who are very smart, very fast learners was kind of the key to a success in a startup, as opposed to trying to get someone who had, you know, if they had 10 years experience doing something, that's great. But the more fundamental characteristic is, would they learn fast on the new problems and the new challenges?
Well, I'd say that the PayPal mafia sure knew how to learn fast.
And because of that, what an incredible product journey that we can tell today. Thanks so much for listening to Rocketship.fm. Rocketship FM now has a premium ad-free feed. All you have to do is go to glow.fm/rocketship and subscribe. It helps support the show, and it gives you an ad-free experience. You actually get an exclusive feed that you can listen to on iTunes or wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Yeah, and Rocketship FM is produced in partnership with Product Collective, which is a community for software product people. Product Collective is also the home of Industry, the Product Conference, Industry Virtual Workshops, and one of the largest Slack groups for product people anywhere.
And we're also on the Podglomerate Network, so a huge thanks to Podglomerate. You can listen to all the Podglomerate shows at thepodglomerate.com. We'll see you here next week on Rocketship.fm.